Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Mayor Kathy Sheehan has signed legislation officially establishing the city of Albany as the first municipality in New York State to opt in to the Good Cause Eviction Law. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there and filed this report.
Good Cause Eviction protects tenants from unreasonable rent hikes and retaliatory or discriminatory evictions, ensuring fair leases and stable housing for the city's residents. Albany had previously passed good cause eviction protections in 2021, but the efforts were halted when a court ruled only the state was allowed to pass the measure. 11th Ward Common Councilor Alfredo Ballarin, himself a landlord, says the new law will have little impact on good landlords.
I'm optimistic that it's going to raise the bar for everybody. You know, I do expect that landlords are going to have probably stricter leases moving forward, as well as stricter guidelines for people who are looking for apartments. And I think, you know, that's important for us to recognize and also, you know, rise to the occasion and make sure that tenants are very well aware of what they're signing and what they're agreeing to and what are the terms of the agreements and what are the expectations, so that when they sign a lease, they understand that it's a contract. And, you know, if you break the lease, that is a good cause for eviction.
Kenyon Ryan is executive director of United Tenants of Albany.
So now that the mayor has signed good cause eviction, tenants can feel secure in their home, knowing that their landlord can no longer evict them for no reason at all, but instead they'll have to provide one of 11 reasons, all of which are totally within the bounds of a good landlord needing to remove a tenant. And it will also put a limit on rent gouging insofar as a landlord can no longer increase rent more than, you know, 5% plus the CPI, which is a measure of inflation, the Consumer Price Index, or 10%, whichever is less, unless the landlord can prove that they need to increase it beyond that amount due to, you know, say they invested in a washer dryer in the basement. Now the tenant has access to that. But because of that, they had to increase the rent 10%. And 5% plus the CPI was only 7.8%. So the landlord can justify the need to increase the rent based on, you know, a benefit in the tenant's living standards upon the new lease. So basically, a tenant can know that their landlord can't be increased beyond a certain extent without cause, and they can't be evicted without cause.
Ryan suggests tenants who believe they've been subjected to an unfair rate increase first try working things out with their landlord. If they don't get satisfaction, the next step is to call United Tenants or Legal Aid for assistance and possibly a trip to court.
This protection is only going to work when a tenant stands by their rights. How that will go is going to be up to the judge and how they determine it. I think that the way that the law finally passed is purposefully confusing for a lot of tenants, which is why in Albany we defined a small landlord as one, as, you know, those with one unit or less, and defined the maximum fair market rent as 345%, the FMR.
According to the Common Council, residents will now receive guaranteed lease renewals, protections against eviction without good cause, and the ability to challenge unreasonable rent hikes. The new law differs slightly from the state version, exempting landlords who own one unit instead of the state law's 1 to 10 units, as well as units with rent higher than 345% of the fair market value. Joining Albany and Kingston, the Poughkeepsie Common Council voted unanimously to opt in on Tuesday. It also exempts landlords who only own one rental unit. Under the new state law, buildings constructed after 2009 and owner-occupied units with 10 or fewer units are exempt.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has issued its draft third five-year review of General Electric's removal of harmful PCBs from the Hudson River. The long-awaited report does not make a determination, saying more data is needed. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard reports.
GE wrapped up dredging on a 40-mile section of the Upper Hudson between Fort Edward and Troy in 2015. EPA says while there has been an overall decline in PCB concentrations in fish and water samples, more study and data collection is needed before it can determine if the cleanup is meeting the needs of the original plan. EPA Regional Administrator Lisa Garcia spoke with reporters Wednesday.
The conclusion for the need for more study and data collection does not mean that EPA will wait another 5 years to decide. And this is a really important point because we recognize that while the five-year review report is coming out now, that soon we'll have more data that we can assess and evaluate and review.
The agency says the eighth year of fish sampling will be completed this fall, with results available in 2025. EPA says data from sediment sampling is not sufficient enough, and additional sampling will be completed in 2026. Again, Garcia.
EPA has proposed to enhance the monitoring and analysis to look more closely at water, fish, and sediment in specific areas in the river. And you'll see in this report some of those special studies are already underway and listed. In collaboration with the state, New York State DEC, we will be collecting more data as part of the special studies to give us more robust and specific information.
The EPA says its five-year review included input from state, federal, and community stakeholders. Garcia acknowledged concerns related to the effectiveness of fish advisories.
One thing that came up throughout this process with the community advisory group, other meetings that we've been having, is a huge concern around the health issue and environmental justice issue, and concerns around fish consumption, especially subsistence fishing. And so we just want to make it clear that fish consumption advisories and fishing restrictions are a part of the cleanup plan that EPA selected for the Upper Hudson River in 2002. And that remains and will continue to be necessary to protect people's public health.
Garcia says EPA will continue to coordinate with the New York State Department of Health on fish advisories and outreach efforts. While EPA is not making a determination of protectiveness now, the agency says it will not wait for the next five-year review to do so. An addendum is expected in 1 to 3 years. EPA Hudson River Field Office Director Gary Klawinski spoke about the ongoing fish sampling efforts.
We're in the time period of getting close to knowing that we can assign a reliable trend to the fish. So that's why we are where we are.
Not included in the review are EPA's ongoing investigations on the Upper Hudson River floodplain and the Lower Hudson. Fish and water sampling on the Lower Hudson began last year. Klawinski says EPA is continuing to collect data with additional resources already available.
We've historically collected fish data and water, some fish data and water data in the Lower River. So that is there's reports for the historical data. New York State DEC collects fish data in the Lower Hudson. So they have a long record before we started collecting also. So there's data there for sure. And then we supplemented with a large fish collection and crab collection last year. And this year we're focusing a lot on sediment. And you'll be seeing reports coming out on all of that as we progress along.
The EPA is collecting public comment on the draft third five-year review through October 8th. A public meeting on the report is scheduled for August 21st. Garcia encourages the public to review the report on the EPA's Hudson River Cleanup website.
EPA has made all this data and analysis available. We encourage independent review. We encourage questions on what the information is. We want to hear from all interested parties. And again, we really appreciate the passion by the public, everyone around the Hudson River, as we continue this road to recovery.
GE said in a statement, quote, "The Hudson River dredging project removed the vast majority of PCBs from the Upper Hudson, led to broad declines in PCB levels, and is on track to deliver further improvements," end quote.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with John Caney. He's the executive director of Reinvent Albany. They look at transparency in government, and he was upset about the failed congestion pricing plan for New York City and told me exactly why.
Sure. I mean, we, Reinvent Albany and many others, believe that Governor Hochul's decision to interfere with congestion pricing being turned on by the MTA was one of the worst decisions and biggest debacles, fiascos, you pick the word, daft works to that we've ever seen in New York State. The reason for that is because, one, as governor, she's choosing to ignore the law, aka break the law, which congestion pricing was passed as part of law in 2019. And the governor, in fact, does not have the legal authority to just ignore laws that she does not like, despite. And so we're not just disappointed, we're dismayed by the complete failure of her stewardship and dereliction of duty, basically, in coming in just interfering with a law that was passed years ago and has been going through a public process that has involved, wait for it, 200 public meetings at least over 4 years, and an incredibly elaborate environmental impact statement, et cetera, et cetera. And the damage that she has done to her own reputation here by this extremely reckless act and to the economy of the whole state is phenomenal. I mean, this is a governor that likes to talk about jobs and affordability. And as Reinvent Albany has shown in a couple of reports, her actions are directly endangering 103,000 to 110,000 full-time New York State jobs. And this is a stunning, stunning act of foolishness by the governor, not just for people who care about the MTA and subway, bus, train riders in downstate, but also for hundreds of thousands of jobs in upstate where the MTA buys all kinds of stuff, ranging from full rail cars to, you know, those yellow plastic strips that go on the side of subway platforms. So we think it's pretty notable that some of the governor's usually staunchest allies in Albany, including the big real estate interests from New York City and big corporate interests that really are the backbone of the governor's institutional support, have just been blasting her for this. And it's hard to overstate what a total blunder this is, because there is no plan B, plan C, plan D to replace the revenue, which is $15 billion in MTA capital funds, because the MTA has already budgeted and essentially spent via planning that money. And any plan B or plan C, new tax, new revenue source, takes away money from the next capital plan for the MTA, which starts next year. So it's a mind blower of a foolish thing for the governor to have done, and detonated on the last day of session, essentially, or the last couple of days of the session, which had a cascading effect of also crowding out some important environmental legislation that has long been sought to help combat global warming. And all in all, just a tremendously bad way to end the session, and really, really cast doubt on the governor's judgment and her common sense.
You're listening to The Capital Connection. He is John Caney, executive director and co-founder of Reinvent Albany. I'm David Gustina. Of course, you mentioned the crowding out of the environmental legislation, but congestion pricing is environmental, right? Because you'd reduce congestion in the city, less cars, less pollution. Then you have the other side of this, because you're going to charge people $15, right, for entering the city. And that issue is seen by many in the political world as another tax. That was part of her argument. So does it make any sense? Is that why she did it? What do you think?
I mean, the gossip or the thinking is that Albany insider thinking is that the governor was asked by Democrats, national Democrats, to, quote, pause congestion pricing or pull the plug on it to appease suburban voters who were disgruntled about it, so as to in that way to protect potential Democratic congressional House seats in Long Island and the Mid-Hudson, New York City suburbs. That's the reasoning for it. The idiotic thing about that is that nobody likes, no member of the public likes toll hikes or tax hikes or fees. And if you ask anyone, you know, would you rather have a free lunch or pay for lunch? They're going to say, sure, if it's the same lunch, I'd rather have it for free. Why not? So there's no such thing as a popular usage toll hike or a tax hike that people want. But guess what? The tax on employees and payroll tax under the MTA's payroll mobility tax, which is one of its biggest sources of revenue, is extremely unpopular with employers and labor unions, and yet it was still voted on and passed. Why? Because it's essential.
That's John Caney, Executive Director of Reinvent Albany. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York Power Authority has unveiled what it says is the largest high-speed EV charging plaza between Albany and the Canadian border. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
The Power Authority is working with the State Department of Transportation to complete Phase 1 of a National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure, or NEVI, project to build an EV network along the state's major highways. 12 Evolve New York charging ports and 8 Tesla ports have been electrified at the Frontier Town Gateway in North Hudson, just off Northway Exit 29. New York Power Authority Manager of Project Engineering for the E-Mobility Group, Jim Bright, says the location is pre-wired for 4 additional stations to be added.
This is our 43rd site, I believe, roughly. So we're about 170 chargers in the Evolve New York network. There's obviously a lot of other public charging available as well. We're working on getting to about 400 ports by the end of next year. So the goal is to be less than 50-mile intervals on all the major corridors in the state. Our goal is EV charging is a no-brainer. You pull in, you charge, you're on your way in short order.
The North Hudson power stations have been designed similar to gas stations so that large vehicles and those towing trailers and boats can pass through. Port Henry resident Walter Cheney has owned a Rivian EV for about a year and a half. He says the design of the new charging plaza has been needed.
One of the biggest complaints I would have probably owning an EV and using an EV as a truck like we do this one is towing. I do tow with it quite a bit, and it's really inconvenient for EV owners to try to find a spot to pull into a charging station. For example, Plattsburgh by Sam's Club is impossible. To pull in there, you'd have to unhook your trailer and then move the vehicle over and then try to go back and rehook. To have a pull-through for the towing aspect is just, it's what everyone needs to have. Everyone coming off the interstate can pull in and charge if they're towing here, because most EVs, you're only going to get between 100 and 200 miles of towing. So from Albany to here, that's important. Like, this is a game changer.
Frontier Town Gateway Travel Plaza owner Mo Ahmed notes that the first canopy over any EV power station in the state is in the planning stage to be installed at his location, as are additional power ports. He finds the power stations benefit travelers and his business.
This is one of the best locations in the whole Northway, from Albany to Montreal. It's right at the center. Almost, I mean, it takes, after 2-3 hours, you need a break. Either you got to go to the bathroom or your vehicle needs a refuel. So I think it's a perfect spot to take a break right off the exit. You don't have to wander around. And it's working out fine for the commuters and for me. I do not make anything out of the charging at all. It's just a convenience for the people. And in return, I get customers.
There are also Evolve New York charging stations in Scroon Lake, Keene Valley, and Plattsburgh.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
A paddling race in the Adirondacks is making a resurgence. The Willard Hanmer Race was created in the 1960s, named after a well-known guideboat builder from Saranac Lake. The Legislative Gazette's Emily Russell was at the finish line last weekend and brings us this story.
If the 90-miler canoe race is a marathon, the Willard Hanmer is a sprint. And yes, it's Hanmer, not Hamner. A lot of people mispronounce it as if the M comes before the N, which it doesn't. Anyways, the Hanmer starts on Lake Flower and ends less than 4 miles away on the Saranac River. Just 28 and a half minutes into this year's race, the first finisher surges up the river.
John.
Saranac Lake local John Dupree glides across the finish line. He immediately gets out of his boat and jumps into the river. It's around 80 degrees and sunny out here today. Once he's fully cooled off, I asked Dupree how his race went.
It was hot, it was fast, and it was fun.
The guideboat Dupree raced in is a beautiful wooden one with sleek lines. Dupree is the third generation of men in his family to row a guideboat in this race, the first dating back to the inaugural Willard Hanmer race back in the early 1960s.
Grandfather rode in it. He did. He won the first year and the second year. And then my dad, he was one heck of a racer. I'm 3.5 minutes off of his fastest time ever, which was 25:30. But he had a lighter boat. But yeah, he's inspired me. I got into it when I was a kid, and gives you something to look forward to every year.
Willard Hanmer built guideboats in Saranac Lake. He learned the craft from his father. Hanmer died in 1962, and a race was then organized to honor the boat builder. Today, there are more than just guideboats in this race. There are categories for 1, 2, and 4-person canoes, as well as kayaks. Sue Dyer, who runs the Hanmer now, says it was her kids who encouraged her to revive the race.
They live in Saranac Lake now, and the race hadn't been run for 10 years plus. So they said, come on, Mom, we ought to be able to do this. Every year it's gotten a little bit better, a little bit better, and and we're doing okay, I think.
Woo! Thank you.
Dyer is also one of the founders of the 90-miler canoe race. She says what makes this race so special is that it's really a community one, one that's family-friendly and feels low stakes. But still, Dyer says a lot goes into the Willard Hanmer.
Even though it's a one-day event, there are so many complicated pieces and bits and state laws and water aquatic laws. And so, yeah, it takes several hard working months and probably 44 volunteers, 50 volunteers.
There are also local businesses here selling things like cotton candy and local craft beer. It's like a summer kickoff party. But there are paddlers that come here really to compete. Becky Sutter and Dylan Kirk both got into paddling a while back when they were students at Paul Smith College. The two won this year's 2-person canoe category, and they came prepared.
We race pretty seriously in pro boats. Dylan put together a training weekend. We've been paddling on the Saranac, over in Rainbow Lake.
Yep.
Tell me about the boat. Like, I've never, it's kind of got like curves to it.
I could talk about this for a few hours. Do you? I don't know how much time you have, but it's called a pro boat.
Since we don't have a few hours, I'll just tell you it's a pretty odd-looking canoe. The front looks normal, but the back half curves inward where the back paddler sits. Here's Kirk explaining.
In the back half of the canoe, the stern gunnels are tucked in, which makes it nicer for the stern paddler to get a closer stroke. You can kind of put more weight on top of the paddle.
Which makes it a more stable ride for serious paddlers. And that stability comes in handy in this race. Kirk says this course is more dynamic than some others.
the Hamner has a buoy turn. It has wakes from pontoon boats on Lake Flower. It has a carry. It has rapids. It has shallows. It has all of these different things that a tactical racer can take advantage of.
Of course, this kind of tactical thinking isn't top of mind for everyone who races the Hamner.
I gotta have a team picture here, too.
Get right in, Ricky.
I love it.
A group of four paddlers huddle into the photo. One woman is wearing a tiara.
My name is Queen Liz Murray from Saranac Lake.
And queen of what?
Queen of the 2024 Creepy Carnival, Saranac Lake Winter Carnival. And I would like to introduce my Chamberlain, Jim Sloan, my Archbishop, Marla McGinnis, and my King, Ricky Sullivan.
Ricky, can you just, like, what was it like to cross the finish line here?
It was awesome. For my very first time.
Yeah.
And I'll do it again if I had to.
Good job, you guys. You did it.
This race does seem to draw people back year after year, generation after generation. Like Carnival Queen Liz Murray. She credits the community vibe and the leadership of Sue Dyer for why this race is so popular.
I was in it in the 70s, and it was huge then, and Sue ran it then, and she's bringing it back, and it's fun, and I hope more people do it every year. It's great.
Yeah!
In Saranac Lake, I'm Emily Russell.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2428 and join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.